So how would Goldie's Act address those problems?
So the first requirement of Goldie's Act would be for more frequent inspections of licensed breeding facilities. You would think that the facilities are probably regularly inspected, but in fact there's no requirement in law currently for any particular frequency of inspection. So some facilities could go for years without being inspected at all. Goldie's Act would first require the agency to inspect every licensed facility at least once a year. The second is life-saving interventions for suffering animals. The agency already has the authority and we believe the legal obligation to confiscate animals that are found to be suffering as a result of violations of the Animal Welfare Act. So as in Goldie's case, the inspectors observed her for a series of months, basically starving to death. And they took no action. And as I said, it wasn't not just bad inspectors here. This was USDA's policy. But Goldie's Act would force the agency in a situation like that to confiscate the animal, to take it and get it the medical care that it requires. It would prevent the agency from turning a blind eye to animal suffering, which is its current policy. It's incredible, but in the 5 years preceding fiscal year 2022, despite documenting thousands of violations of the Animal Welfare Act, the agency did not confiscate a single animal. The agency did not revoke the license of a single dog dealer, and the agency did not impose a single monetary penalty against the licensed dog dealer in those 5 years. That is how bad the agency's lack of enforcement is.
You know, one of the things that is unusual about Goldie's Act is that it does have, especially these days, this is so rare, it does have bipartisan sponsorship. So where does it stand right now?
You know, that's one of the great things about a lot of animal-related legislation, particularly when we're talking about companion animals, is that it's not a partisan issue. Democrats and Republicans all have dogs. And we all love our pets. And so, you know, it has not been that difficult in Congress for us to find bipartisan support. So the bill was introduced in the previous session. It was recently reintroduced in the House of Representatives by a bipartisan team. And we do expect a Senate version of the bill to be introduced soon as well. You know, the Farm Bill is the single most influential piece of legislation on our food system. You know, directly impacts the lives of billions of animals. And it does provide, you know, an opportunity to also enact reforms that prevent puppy mill cruelty. So we are working with lawmakers and many folks in the animal welfare community are working with lawmakers to get positive provisions into the Farm Bill if that's possible. We'll see. You know, the Farm Bill is one of those must-pass pieces of legislation. So if we are lucky enough to get something in there, then that may be the way that we can get, you know, some or all the provisions of Goldie's Act.
That was Robert Hensley, Legal Advocacy Senior Counsel for the ASPCA, talking about Goldie's Act, which, if passed, will force the USDA to step up enforcement of laws that protect dogs in puppy mills.
That was an excerpt of Michelle Coppola's reporting on animal welfare. You are tuned in to a special edition of the KBOO Evening News, the best of 2023. If you've enjoyed the KBOO Evening News this year, consider supporting us with a donation. It's very easy to do, and every dollar counts. You can go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Now, I also got the chance to catch up with Ken Jones about some of his favorite stories from the past year. Hey, Ken, thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, thanks for putting me on the best of list, Althea. I didn't make it in the past 7 years, so this is a first.
It's a new list, Ken. It's a new list.
Yes. Apparently, the quality has gone down a bit, but I'll take it.
Well, you mentioned 7 years. How long have you been at KBOO? How long have you been involved in the newscast?
Oh, well, I started KBOO, I think, September 2013, so a little over 10 years now. And as part of the training, I originally wanted to do radio theater, which I did and still do a little bit of. But as part of the training, there was an obligation to give back and to volunteer for things that were probably more critical to the station, like the news. So I started then. I started doing interviews, usually on the phone, a few live, and then did some interviews co-anchoring the news and really never left the news. It was just a lot of fun.
What are some of your favorite things about the news department?
Well, Alfie, I think we'll start with you. you've been doing a great job, and you got us through the pandemic, which was absolutely amazing, and you get so many people involved. I contribute a lot of arts and culture, but when I'm anchoring or when I was doing some interviews before for the news, I got to do some local figures, politics, newsmakers, people in the community, and I just enjoyed what KBOO brings to people through the news, which is really news about the whole community. And I think a few stories that might not be covered quite as much elsewhere, or certainly they would be covered in a different way.
Well, for the record, I wasn't fishing for any compliments about that, but I appreciate it all the same.
No, I mean it. It's not something I made up just because you're talking to me now.
Well, if I knew this best of thing was going to get me here, I would have done it way sooner. Anyway, of the stories that you've done for KBOO in the news the past year, what are some of your favorite stories?
Well, I actually put a list.
in jail and then were released and couldn't finish it and had found us and found the book they needed. And so I think that what I realized was relationship was a huge component and being part of a community. And very quickly, that first summer I was by myself, but very quickly I became recognizable as I'd roll up and people would come. And particularly powerful was me saying, "Hey, Jeffrey, I brought your book this week." And it was, you know, a guy who wanted book three of Harry Potter or any other interesting title. And so that was a powerful thing also for building relationships, for knowing one another's name, for knowing what people most like to read. That was something I saw very quickly was a service I could offer, was of value to people. They did not have to provide anything, no ID. They didn't have to fill out a form. So in some ways, it was maybe a refreshing point of contact. They didn't have to endure some bureaucratic process in order to receive something. This, I felt like, was a collaboration. And that is something we've talked about a lot at Street Books, the idea that it is not a charitable organization, but that it's in fact an arts organization that offers a service, but it's very much a collaboration between librarians and patrons who, on some of their worst days, come and find the library and have conversations, you know? And so that very much requires them to extend themselves, and we appreciate that. That's certainly not something we take for granted.
Let's talk a little bit about the patrons. In the book Loners, you write that in 2009, so just before you launched Street Books, which I think was 2011, Oregon ranked first per capita in the U.S. for people experiencing houselessness. Have you seen any progress, or does the problem seem to be getting worse on the streets of Portland?
Oh, man. Well, I think, you know, as we all know, the pandemic was particularly, the impact of that on cities across the states was profound. And I think we've seen a huge uptick in numbers of people outside or very much at the margins, kind of living out of a car. And then the setbacks encountered by public spaces, community rooms where people had gone for meals, any place that it was possible to go inside, like the Multnomah County Library, so much of that was closed, and that our patrons experienced more exposure just to the elements than ever. And so what we've seen since then is really a trend away from public spaces opening back up for people like our patrons. And so they really are outside. And, you know, a couple of days ago, I shadowed librarians on a shift in Old Town and around the Greyhound station. And I was really struck by how people were outside without enough winter gear.
The past few days have been brutal, too.
So wet and so cold. And I just was really struck by how our systems have broken down. And I know that, you know, I actually went home after that shift, called for a welfare check on a person that I was very concerned about, sitting in a wheelchair down by the Greyhound station. And they actually dispatched a person. And so I was relieved to see that my wait time was like 10 minutes. I talked to a person that was very concerned and that immediately was able to route a person to check on that guy that I'd seen. And so in some ways, I know that there are systems and there are checks in place and supports. But I really do feel like we are seeing an impasse at the county and city level and a lot of frustration about the system not working to take care of people like it should, like I would hope it would, you know?
Now, I'd like to talk about the book a little before we get to the fundraiser. And you wrote that with Ben Hodgson, who you call Hodge, the book's Loners, The Making of a Street Library. It not only tells the story about Street Books and your partnership with Hodge, but helps us see the humanity in the people we tend to avoid or ignore on the streets. And I love this quote from your website. Each human is a walking secret history, a book of adventures and misadventures, sorrows and triumphs and humor. It doesn't take long to look around and wonder about the larger forces at work that have resulted in some people climbing into a tent on the sidewalk for the night while others take the elevator to their loft. Those of us who are not houseless, I think, don't realize how thin a line there is between those two. We've been talking with Laura Moulton, executive director and street librarian at Street Books, the bicycle-powered mobile library for those living outside in Portland. The annual Portland Fermentation Festival, affectionately known as Stinkfest, is back this year after a three-year hiatus due to the pandemic. The festival returns for the 11th time since it started in 2009, this Thursday, October 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. at EcoTrust's Irving Street Studio and Rooftop Terrace in Portland's Pearl District. We hosted the festival organizers Liz Crane, Heidi Nessler, and Claudia Lucero, collectively known as the Stinkfest Queens, for a preview of the 10th annual event in 2019. And we're fortunate to have two of the queens here with us today, Liz and Heidi. Thanks so much for coming into KVU, bearing samples of some of the treats you'll be featuring at the festival. And Claudia, if you're listening, we miss you.
Oh, thanks for having us on, Ken.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Liz, let's start with you. You were one of the organizers of the very first Portland Fermentation Festival in 2009.
Yeah.
How did it come together? It was a much smaller fermentation community at the time, wasn't it?
It was. A couple friends and I decided that we wanted to have something where we could gather everyone together, a lot of amateur makers, and kind of open up the world of fermentation to Portlanders. And it went really, really well. And Heidi's been a part of it from year one as yeah. well. But we had a line around the block, and kids always have gotten in for free, so kids 12 and younger, lots of young, hungry to ferment and sample ferment kiddos there. Yeah.
Now, fermentation has been around for thousands of years. Not only has it brought us healthy and tasty things to eat, but it's been essential in preserving foods before the age of refrigerators and freezers. When I posted on social media about the festival, a friend commented, "Isn't the correct term for fermentation when applied to anything but yogurt, beer, wine, and kombucha?" He's got a very narrow view there, called rotting. And I would say the chemical process is similar, but the results are very different.
Right. I think that you do get a lot of like textural changes and flavor changes, even the color of foods change as they ferment. But, you know, I think that most people would attest who've been to the fermentation festival, that process makes things more delicious. And so it's not a yucky rotting thing. Although there are some acquired flavors for a lot of the foods that are fermented and that
I know that's true
try.
With some cheeses yeah. I've had. But you know, it's a matter of taste.
Exactly.
It won't kill you.
Yeah.
That's for sure. We've been talking with Liz Crane and Heidi Nessler, two of the organizers of the 11th annual Portland Fermentation Festival. It's fall here in Portland, traditionally, the beginning of the holiday season. And this year we have even one more reason to celebrate. It's the 100th birthday of Portland Youth Philharmonic, America's longest-running youth orchestra, and certainly the first to turn 100. Dating back to 1924, PYP kicks off its historic season this Saturday, November 11th, at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. The program, titled This Midnight Hour, features works by Anna Klein, Camille Saint-Saëns, and Antonin Dvorak, and according to the concert notes, quote, takes listeners on a journey through the darkest hour into the uplifting embrace of daybreak. I think that journey, driven by the healing power of great music, is one we all can use about now. To help celebrate PYP's 100th season and preview the opening concert, we're fortunate to have David Hattner, PYP's musical director, and Nolan Tu, winner of PYP's 2023 Piano Concerto Competition. David, in the 100-year history of Portland Youth Philharmonic, there have been thousands of young musicians taking part, but only five musical directors. Not only an amazing record of longevity for the orchestra, but one of stability for the leadership. You started with PYP in 2008, so you're now entering your 16th year as musical director. How do you see your role in maintaining tradition, but also moving the organization forward?
Well, tradition has always played a big part in the orchestra. I was fortunate, as we've talked about before, to meet with Jacob Avshalomov during
my
early years Mr. A, who was the original keeper of tradition because he played in the orchestra under its founder, Jacques Gershkovich, and learned by playing in the orchestra and living in the household of the Gershkovich with him and his wife, all about how it works. And then he added his own ideas specifically for programming and contemporary music and contemporary styles of doing things. And then Hugh Edwards and Mann Chen each put their own individual touches on the repertoire. But what always remained was this great spirit of whatever it takes to prepare the concert, that's what the assignment is. It's the assignment for the conductor. It's the assignment for the individual musicians. It's assignment for the parents and the staff and the board. It's whatever it takes at any time. That's the kind of organization we are. It's very easy, I like to say, to be an excuses-based organization because so many things in life are difficult or challenging or impossible, if you want to think of them that way. And we're just, whatever it takes, that's what we're going to do. And the spirit remains amongst the musicians. They want very much to have a similar experience to their predecessors, and they know it's their responsibility to make that effort. At least a handful of musicians are second generation, so their parents played in the orchestra, and or at least one of their parents. So their expectations that they're son or daughter will have that experience also exist. And of course, like you said, we have thousands of alumni. And as an alumnus of several things myself, not PYP specifically, sometimes we have this sort of hazy memory of how wonderful something was that may exceed the reality of what it even was. And so, you know, we want to make sure when we experience the modern version that it lives up to our dreamlike memory. But fortunately, most of the alumni, including some who serve on our board, they seem fairly content with this, how we're doing. I think some of what has changed is that the way adults and authority figures are relating to younger people is evolved, even in my 16 years here. I think there's a more respectful approach. Certain of the more blunt tools in our teaching toolkit have had to be mostly shelved, because not because they were necessarily wrong to use, but they're just not that effective anymore. I don't think they respond to the more aggressive outbursts that all of my predecessors and occasionally I have succumbed to over the years. So I try to keep the intensity very high, the demands very high, but I understand better than I did how deeply intelligent and committed these musicians are, not just to PYP, but to other things. And so I try to appeal to their sense of integrity about what their expectations should be of themselves, rather to just be upset that they are not where I need them to be in any given moment. And it does seem to work, although we'll find out on Saturday if it's still working this year.
Speaking of which, that concert on Saturday, the 100th season opener, is titled This Midnight Hour, and it gets its name from the Anna Klein piece featured in the program. How'd you go about selecting the pieces to fit that theme? I think you usually start with the piano concerto competition winner's piece, which in this case is the Saint-Saëns Piano Concerto No. 2.
Yeah, we've often put the piano concerto winner, which we do every second year, on the opening concert. And I needed something that would contrast with the rather lighthearted and frothy nature of that Saint-Saëns concerto. It's not quite what you would call one of the more intellectual of the piano concertos. It's for fun and also to really delight the audience. And another thing that's delighted audiences for many, many years are pieces that have some terror in them. So while the Saint-Saëns is like a frothy concoction, Anna Klein's This Midnight Hour is a little like A Night on Bald Mountain from Mussorgsky. It's haunted. It's got sounds in it that are, some of them are dissonant, but mostly they're ominous. And then at the end, it transforms and becomes more like a hymn or a chorale, similar to what Night on Bald Mountain does. And so I thought, since audiences have always enjoyed these pieces that sound like they come from a scary movie or actually come from a movie soundtrack, that they would really enjoy This Midnight Hour and the invited guests we've had visit rehearsals of it were struck by its brilliant orchestration and just the power of its ideas. So I think it turned out to be a pretty good choice, but I just discovered it like many people do on YouTube by searching for Anna Klein, who's a well-known composer whose music is widely performed. And this piece really struck me as like, that's something you could open a season with.
We've been talking with David Hattner, musical director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic, and Nolan Tu, winner of PYP's 2023 Piano Concerto Competition.
Those were some of the highlights from Ken Jones's stories in 2023. You've been listening to a special edition of the KBOO Evening News, the best of 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we can't do it without your help. Consider donating to KBOO during the last week of our end-of-year campaign. KBOO.fm/give is the website link to donate, but you can also text the word KBOO to 44321. I'd like to personally thank all of the volunteer reporters who contributed to the newscast this past year. I'm so grateful for your work and perspective and your service to the community. Thank you to all of the KBOO members and donors who've supported us this year, and thank you for listening. For KBOO, I'm Althea Billings.
Listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in the middle of our end-of-year campaign. Help us meet our $75,000 goal by making a contribution today. KBOO's different hues of independent programming are only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. You can also donate by texting KBOO to 44321 or by mailing a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon, 97214. Help shine some light on our radio community by donating now.
Are you a fan of early rock and roll, doo-wop, rhythm and blues, and 70s rock?